Appreciate the presence of everyone this afternoon. Appreciate the good song service. Appreciate that good meal. It was just excellent. The food was good. The desserts were good. And I now know, yes, that you're sleepy. I don't know how short this will be.
We're all holding our breath.
I'll try not to tarry. I'll try not to belabor. I don't know if I'll get to all of these, and we'll just let it go wherever we are. But there's some great lessons to be learned from situations where people were just waiting for things. You know, you can wait for something in at least two major ways. You can fold your hands or your arms and just, you know, sit and wait. Oftentimes in a waiting room at a hospital, you know, you just sit there and you contemplate, or if you brought a book or a puzzle, you might do something like that, or chatter with the family or visit. Sometimes if it's a very serious situation, you may be silently praying part of the time. But a lot of times, you know, you're just waiting without a whole lot of occupation. Other times, you're waiting for things while you are very much so occupied. You're busy. And yet there's something looming on the horizon. There's some expectation. There's an anticipation. Something's going to happen. And you're waiting to learn, to get more information. You're waiting for an event, perhaps, or whatever. I remember one time when we were living in Cleburne, Texas. We'd come back from Tennessee, one of the several times back from Tennessee, across the Mississippi River. And we were preaching for the Granberry Street Church in Cleburne, Texas. And we'd 10, 11 months before, we'd had to walk off and leave our farm, our house, our work, because of money. The money ran out. And so we were preaching and teaching and living. And I said to June one day, I wish something would happen. I mean, it was just, I was enjoying my work, I think, but my economy was down the tubes. I mean, it was so far down there, it was very bad. Worst year of my life. And I've had several bad years. And that was the pits of the pits. And I told her one day, I said, I wish something was happening. And it wasn't long after that we got a call and we got to go back to Tennessee and try it again. And we tried it again for another 2 years till the money ran out again. And then we left for other places. But you're sometimes just waiting for a word or waiting for something or else. And there's so many times in the Bible when we're introduced to situations and people where it was like that with them. They were waiting on something. And I want us to learn a few lessons with regard to these cases. The first one I take from the book of Job, because Job was waiting for an explanation that never arrived. I need to learn something from that. I like on occasion to get explanations. Now, sometimes explanations can hurt. You know, if somebody, well, why did you say that to me? Or why did you do that? And then the explanation maybe is far worse than what you thought it would be. But Job was wanting an explanation as to why his human condition had reversed itself so suddenly and extremely. He went all the way from a well-respected, God-fearing, socially acceptable and impressive, influential, wealthy person to sitting in a heap of ashes outside of town and nobody wanted to be around him anymore. And it happened, I can't snap my fingers anymore, but it happened just like that. Just like that. Lost his family, lost his wealth, lost his prestige in the community, and people turned against him. And he didn't know how to adapt. And he didn't know what to make of it all. And so he's wanting, as his friends are trying to, if you put the word console in quotation marks, their consolation turned out to be an accusation. And yet they just came, talked to him, and thought they could encourage him. And by the time the whole thing was over, they had accused him of sin. Good night. He's gone from worse, bad to worse. And Job still maintained his integrity because he knew that there was nothing in his character that had changed, that had brought this tumult about? Nothing. Their explanations were worthless. He countered them as best he could in his own way. But also in the give and take between him and his friends, he would on occasion boldly declare, you know, his integrity, that's true, but then, I wish God would show up. God has turned against me. Wasn't true. But that's the way he was explaining things to himself and interpreting these horrendous events. He's turned against me. I wish he'd show up and have an indictment written against me. I'd like to talk with God about this. Now, God showed up all right in chapter 38. But he never gave him an explanation. Never did. We read of it in the first two chapters of the book. Job didn't have the book. Job didn't know about that discussion between the devil and God and all the confidence that God had expressed to the devil that God had in Job. Hast thou considered my servant Job? There's nobody like him in all the earth. If Job had just known of that one statement, although those two little remarks, he would have taken everything quietly. If he just had that, there's my servant Job. There's no one like him on the earth. If he had known God thinks that much of me, that's the way God has appraised my condition, I don't care what happens to me in life, I'm holding on to God. But he didn't know that. So he got brazen. I want an explanation. God shows up, but he doesn't give him one. And he has to live the rest of his life without one. So the next time that I feel so emboldened as to think that I do need explanations about a lot of things that God has felt quite happy with leaving silent, I need to remember that. There are things about you that I'll never understand in this life. There are things about me that I will not know in this life. As you evaluate yourself, you say, well, I'm like this and this and this. Then you say, well, why am I like this or this and this? God knows. God knows. There are things that come into character formation, the development of personality, of which only God is aware. Only God can do that. And so I don't have to have everything explained. As far as He can explain it, if He wants to, fine. If He doesn't want to, it's His business. The Bible cautions me about raising critical questions in the sense of a criticizing question against God. Matthew 7, however, 21 through 23, and Matthew 25, there is going to come a day of explanation for everybody with regard to his destiny. You've heard me say before, the judgment is not a day of a decision. It's a day of explanation. And in Matthew 25, Jesus is discussing the way that God explains things to the church. He's not talking about why you're saved or lost on the basis of your conversion. You were all converted. But you're now saved. You're on my right hand because I was hungry. And you had pity on me. And I was thirsty. I was naked. I was in prison. I was a stranger. And you helped me. Here's how it happened. When one of my brethren, one of the least of my brethren, was in these sorts of situations and you ministered to them, you were doing it to me. In other words, you do it to the body, you do it to the head. We've talked about the body of Christ, Colossians 1:18. One head, one body. That's true. And that's what Jesus is saying in effect. If you do it to one of my members, you're doing it unto me. Or on the other hand, when I was in these conditions and you did not minister unto me, the judgment is based on how you loved or despised my body, the church. That's the basis of the judgment in Matthew 25. Explanation. So I need to live in the light of that explanation given in that text, that I'll be prepared for the reckoning, as it were, when it comes in judgment by and by. Number two. Some were waiting for help that they thought was long overdue. I take this from Judges 6, verses 11 and following. There's a case here where the Midianites were pressing Israel. This is in that cyclical period of about 330 years of the judgeship. There's no king yet, but they've got judges. those which are military rulers are people that do physical things to harass the enemy. And Gideon, during this time, he's trying to work on some wheat at a wine press. Evidently, he's trying to hide his harvest by taking it to a wine press, thinking that maybe the Midianites won't think to look here for my grain. Because at this moment, they're very oppressive. And they're stealing from Israel. Some of the Jews have already left their normal habitats and are hiding in caves in the mountains. The oppression was really becoming agonizing. And they're stealing their crops, their food. They're just taking whatever they want. And they've got the power that the Israelites cannot withstand. So here is Gideon one day trying to hide some grain at a wine press and trying to work on it. And an angel shows up to discuss some things with him. And Gideon wants to know if it's because the angel has said that God is with you. Well, if He's with us, where are all the miracles that our fathers told us about? When God was manifestly, personally, directly working in behalf of us, His covenant people. Of course, they've run through another period of apostasy. Great sin. But Gideon and all of the others, I suppose, or many of them, you know, they grew up on the stories, the things handed down, and how that God had done this and this and this. And so where are all of these deliverances? And the angel explains that God is with Gideon and he's going to be the next deliverer. And it all works out in time. But it just shows you the kind of heart that he had and what was in his mind, and maybe in the mind of a lot of Jews by this time. Where are the signs that our fathers told us of? Where are the miracles? Why isn't God moving in history like He once did in behalf of His harassed and very depressed and maligned people? Sometimes that's the way we are at a given moment. And we think the help is long overdue. That's what Gideon was thinking. Waiting for help that seemed long overdue. Maybe it arrived finally in your life. Perhaps it did. Maybe it's like that situation. Number three, some are waiting for John and Jesus. You go back and read the last book, Malachi. They were told to do that. You watch for John and you watch for Jesus. The Lord's coming to His temple. And then all these years begin to go off. You know, I've been on the earth a few years. You've been on the earth a few years. 100 years seems like a long time in a way. 200 years, 300 years, 400 years. You go through that intertestamental period, 400 years, and every generation of Jews was watching for John, watching for the Elijah to come, and watching for the Lord to come to His temple. And all those generations dying out, lived and died while they were waiting. Waiting for the coming of John and the coming of the Lord. And faithful ones never gave up. They never gave in to doubt or to criticism. He's not coming. We must have misunderstood the prophets. We must have misread Malachi. Well, get Malachi and read it and see if you misread it or not. It seems quite plain in a way. And then finally, 400 years later, there's the voice of one crying in the wilderness, as Isaiah said he would be. Prepare the way of the Lord. Make His paths straight. And as Jesus later explained to His apostles, that was the Elijah to come. And as the angel had said to Zacharias, He's going to come in the Spirit and the power of Elijah. That's what that meant. It wasn't a reincarnation of the Old Testament prophet. That John was going to come in the Spirit and the power of Elijah. That's the Elijah to come. And then Jesus came. Finally did. And here we are in our days. Just like for 2,000 years now. Every generation. Waiting on the coming of Christ. Waiting on the coming of Christ. Maybe some gave up. Maybe some reinvestigated. See if they misread the passages. In fact, some of our brethren have done that very thing. They've gone back to the Scriptures to see if somehow we misread the passages, and some of us finally decided the Lord's not personally coming again. We've got some that are saying that. And so they invent a doctrine. They re They invent a new kind of doctrine and getting by and going on the earth that tries to square with some other passages and maybe a lot of imagination and speculation. Don't give up on what is plainly said. Some things are not plainly said in Scriptures. Some passages are quite obscure. I'm not going to base the hope of my soul on an obscure passage. I'm going to take the obscurity in the light of the simplicity. It's all profound in a way, but I'm going to understand the obscure in the light of the simple. I'm not going to deny the simple in the light of the obscure. That's going at it wrong. It's backward. And yet we've already had brethren that have given up on the coming of Christ. He's already come. Sad, sad, sad. Number four, some are waiting on justice. Revelation 6, 9 through 11, John sees a scene in heaven. Lord, when are you going to avenge our blood on those that are upon the earth? 2 Timothy 4, verse 14, Paul says, Alexander the coppersmith did me much evil. The Lord will render to him according to his works. You know, there's nothing wrong with appealing to a sense of justice in your own spirit. There's nothing wrong with wanting justice done. Our country has gotten so imbalanced with regard to obligation and privilege and duty and responsibility. You know, we don't know how to hold anybody guilty of anything anymore. We don't know how to hold people responsible. We just want everything to just let go. Just do what you want to do and don't hold people accountable, responsible. Don't punish, don't penalize. It's the extreme. It's the other extreme of having a mood, a national mood to punish your own people. Like in communism. Where you penalize your own people. You make enemies of your own people. The Communist Party does. And you go at it that way. The other extreme is not punishing anything. And we've arrived at that. Who could have written the script for our day? Who could have imagined the stupidity and the irrational way of trying to carry on a society at the other end of the spectrum where you know nobody's guilty much of anything and we're just going to just act like nobody can help anything. And then we wind up, as we're currently doing, undermining the significance of law. That's what we're now doing. Before our citizens, with our president doing like he does, we are now saying it's okay to violate law. You know, you can. That's okay. You can have citizenship. Now, all of you that obeyed the law, too bad. Too bad for you. You should have waited a little bit longer and just come across like the rest of them did. You know, we're going to reward law breaking. That's what you get into. You reward law breaking. And on the other extreme, it's punishing the innocent. And over here, it's the other extreme. Unintentionally punishing those who are innocent and letting the guilty go free. It's a sad thing. Waiting for justice. There's nothing wrong with wanting justice done. And I want to be as kind-hearted and as civil and as nice as I can possibly be to everybody. But without law, you have an anarchy. You finally wind up in something you created that you didn't intend to create. No respect for law at all. What a horrible moment that will be if we live to see it. Then number five. There were those who were waiting for their prayers to be answered. 2 Corinthians 12, 7 through 10. We have a case where Paul was waiting for his to be answered. The Lord kept saying no. And Paul was hoping God would change his mind. I've prayed like that and you've prayed like that perhaps for things you hadn't gotten yet. But I'll still want it. I still want it, and God's not granting it. And maybe it's going to take several more prayers and maybe several more years. And then it finally comes, or it finally becomes clear to me, I didn't need that, and I shouldn't have been wasting time praying for that sort of thing anyway. But waiting for prayers to be answered, that can be a very serious thing in a person's life, because the thing that he's praying for can be very, very significant. Very important with eternal implications. Waiting for prayers. Number six, there were those that were waiting for the promise in the kingdom. Jesus told his apostles to wait in Jerusalem, Luke 24, 44 and following. Wait there for the promise of the kingdom, the power to come with the Spirit, Acts 1, 4, 5, and 8. And they asked him on that occasion when he was with them, "Dost thou at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Is it time?" Well, he said, "You don't need to know the time." But it so happened it was just a few days away. But they were waiting for that. And so it did in fact come. Then there are those, number 7, waiting for news. This gets a lot of us waiting to hear a report or reply or something. You're very interested in or concerned about the welfare of someone else. Eli, for example, in 1 Samuel 4, was waiting for a battle report. He was concerned about the Ark of the Covenant, that sacred piece of furniture. He was really concerned about that. And he learned that it got taken by the Philistines. Good night. Pagan, idolatrous, enemies of God. And he learned that his sons were killed in battle. Fell back, broke his neck, and died. David, in 2 Samuel chapter 18, verses 19 through 33, waiting too on a battle report and waiting to hear how it was with the boy who had run him out of town, his own son Absalom. And he got the report. And it didn't bother him so much that he had servants that died, but it bothered him when he heard about Absalom dying. But at any rate, he waited a while to get the report. 2 Corinthians 2 and chapter 3, chapter 7, verse 5 and following, Paul was waiting after he wrote what is our book of 1 Corinthians. You know, you go through all of that as we have done chapter by chapter, and there's so many problems with the church. And he has to give so much correction to the church at Corinth. It's just, he said, how in the world could they survive being in such a spiritual mess? And he's trying to correct all that, and he's very anxious to get word back how they received the epistle. And he's touring, he's traveling, and he's hoping Titus is going to find him at a certain place and with word how it went, and he doesn't show up. So he has to go on, and you know, and this is always looming in his mind. Wow, I wonder how the church took the letter. And finally, Titus gets to him in chapter 7, and it's a good report. And they're straightening up their affairs. Oh my, he is so relieved in his spirit. Even though he wrote by the Holy Spirit, the things he wrote, the exact things that needed to be said, but he's wondering how in the world will they take it. And it's bothersome to linger not knowing whether or not they repented or they just entrenched and said, well, who are you? Because there were some of those over there. Who are you? Will they get the upper hand or will the church straighten up its affairs? Waiting on news. Number 8, there are those who wait on death. Genesis 27, Isaac was waiting on his. 2 Timothy 4, Paul was waiting on his. In fact, he knew it was just about there. And that's a very sobering thing. It's one thing for me to talk about death's approach, as I know it is. But I've known that for years and years and years and years and years. But it's another thing when I start talking about it knowing that it's just imminent. And when you start thinking about your death, as you have, that's one thing. But when the doctor says, you know, it looks like your time is about up. You've contracted this, or you've got this, or you only have a few days to live, or whatever. If it comes like that, it's going to be so different than the way that I just describe it as I do it when I preach and I teach. Because then I know finally, here it is. I knew it was coming. But now I have the feeling of it's coming. Not just the intellectual description of its coming, but I am involved emotionally and I know there's no way out. That's different. That's facing it differently than I can right now face it. Waiting on death. And finally, of course, there are those, all of us are waiting for the Lord to come back. 1 Thessalonians 1, 9 and 10, one of the great traits of the brethren at Thessalonica. They changed their ways. Paul commends them for the about face they did. And they had several things that were good about them. And their initial installment in the church involved them in a lot of persecution and conflict in Thessalonica. And they withstood it. And he says, you are a good example to other brethren. Not an example to unbelievers to become believers, but the way you took things on once you got into Christ, you became a great example to believers. And one thing that he commended them for also was that right now he says, you're waiting for the Lord. Now that's 2,000 years ago. But that was the mindset. that all the brethren were to live and die with. And it's still that way. I share that obligation and that privilege with the first century church, living, and while I live, waiting on the coming of Christ. Let us not grow weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. If you're here this afternoon and not a Christian, come in faith, repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ. If you've done that and gone astray, it's a good time to come back. Do it now. While together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?